thanks very much for that, Mike. I think at this stage we'll go into discussion, or if anybody's got any questions, feel free, and we'll see how that goes and take it from there.
Okay.
Thanks for that, Mike. Unfortunately, I think I would probably disagree on everything.
Thought you might.
If we're talking about Marx here, and I think maybe the problem is that while you have Marx's early writings on the desk, you have not accepted him as your personal saviour. Marx's motto was Omnis Dubitantur. I think I've got that dog Latin right. It means doubt everything. Right, which was the sceptical approach, which was the approach prior to Socratic thought, pre-Socratic, with a running sceptical trend then on with Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, whatever, and then into the thought that has underlain the private property society that we're in today. Now, doubt everything means that everything that we are talking about is just... It's not something that is objectively real. Our thought has managed to find, you know, the real thought outside to match. But the point is that we are machines that just produce thoughts. You know, it's like we manufacture it from zero. And since we have done all of that within private property, all of our thought is private property thought. It's running on proprietary software. It's a bit like if you've got a program that's made entirely for Microsoft software, yeah, it's only going to produce Microsoft favourable results. In the same way, yeah, everything that we have thought from the first moment of our lives is not, you know, the thoughts about the world. It's not objective knowledge that has gradually come to us or been told to us by our parents or whatever. All of it is private property thought. It is subject to being capitalism. That's what is meant by the... the thought of every epoch is the thought of the ruling class. It's not that there is somehow some objective level of thought that anyone can have, but then we're all beaten down by newspapers. Yeah? It's that every thought that we have is intrinsically tied up with who we are and how we have lived previously. There is no thought outside of that. Yeah? So that knocks down your free will to start with, because the notion of free will is that you can have this floating, thinking thing that is separate from the world it looks at. We don't have that. But on the other side, determinism itself is precisely private property thought as applied to the worker. Yeah. As I say, it's because our thinking takes place entirely within a private property context. Yeah. Determinism means that we are mediated, as creative creatures. We are mediated by the world outside of us, which is owned by people other than us. Yeah? So when we say we are determined, we are also making a practical and political statement about our place in the world and what we can do in it. Yeah? So determinism is a political creed. It's just that politics is woven into the very structure of the things that we say. Now, instead of taking an analytical, philosophical position or any of these other positions within private property, I would say, I think along with Marx, is that what you need to do is you need to step back and just simply say, I don't know. Yeah? Which is the fundamental, what should be the fundamental scientific position, what Marx would be referring to, for example, when he was talking about trying to find one true science. All that means is, I observe. I don't observe the thing that is out. I'm not trying to make a link of this thought to that thing. Yeah? I realise that all of this is just me organising, my mind and other people's minds around me. And all I say is, I observe. At this time, I was this state. At that time, I was that state. And then abstract from these to put together a more general abstracted picture of where we are, and then put new predictions on what will happen. None of this having some sort of divine connection with the world beyond the senses. It's all in that evolutionary approach to say that basically sort of thought takes place within the animal, whatever you want to say about that. Thought takes place, and then some of these thoughts are evolutionary more favourable than others. Yeah? Think some things and you won't live. If you think you can fly to the fifth floor, you will die. That idea will die off with you. That's how evolution works. You take a consistently evolutionary approach to thought, which really you can run back to evolutionary theory itself, because evolutionary theory, as Darwin expressed it, is only a subset, really, of the sceptical position. I'm pretty much running out of thought here. I'm going through my own reset. This is why I have great problems presenting this kind of thing. I really empathise with you trying to put a scientific talk together. But I think that a very simple point to say that, along with Marx, that if you take the sceptical position, if you just step back and say, I don't know, and you realise that everything that you are trying to know with is private property thought.
Yeah.
It's not the thought, it's not the truth. Yeah. We have no idea what the world is beyond our senses, and our entire existence, as we talk about it, is measured in grams, if you sort of mean. We just don't know anything other than that. Our lives are, you know, the thinking lives that we share with each other, and we apply those to the world, and some of those thoughts are better than others, yeah? And some of those thoughts we don't walk away from. You know, if you think that trains are made of soft, fluffy cheese or something, you stand in front of one, that idea dies with you, you know. Take the sceptical position. You do not end up in all the kind of shenanigans that conventional philosophers, and philosophers are slaves to scientists, and scientists are slaves to philosophers, and between the two of them, they were both slaves of private property thought that they are isolated moments of. So, for example, you have a academic trying to preach to, as a philosopher, trying to preach to technicians about how to make artificial intelligence, getting it horribly wrong. And then on the other side, you'll get the technicians trying to tell the philosophers, you know, people like Dawkins trying to tell philosophers and about this, and all that goes wrong. Anyway, I'm taking too much time, so I'll shut up there.
And if I could come back on a couple of points?
If you want to on that, yeah, whilst you fresh your mind, yeah, sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, you started out saying that you sort of disagree with not everything I said, but I like to think that some of the points you made were at least compatible with some of the points I was making, in that, you know, you quite rightly point out that that sort of doubt and scepticism is sort of a part of what Marxists should do. And hopefully I've applied sort of scepticism and doubt to some of the... you know, the scientific consensus, or either on the, you know, the deterministic approach or the free will one. But I suppose I'd take issue with what you say about concepts like free will and determinism being private property concepts, in that the discussion on them began, you know, the discussion on free will or determinism sort of predates capitalism. It doesn't predate property society, unless, well, for all we know, people in primitive communism might have been having the same debates, even if it's not recorded for us to know about it. But I don't know, I'm guessing that in a different form, I'm sure it would be in a different form, that the free will determinism debate will have some kind of successor throughout whatever the human future brings. So I think that some of these issues, all right, they dress themselves up in different guises according to the state of the property society and also the state that science and technology is in. But I don't know, I'd say that some of these concerns, if they're not universal, then they could predate and post-date capitalism, even if they would manifest themselves in completely different forms according to the society that these questions and issues arise in.
Hold on a minute, that's...
I just think that, you know, you're saying, like, I don't know, you know. I mean, there's, for me, that's kind of like a really reactionary kind of, like, thing, you know, to tell people, really, you know, we don't know, because there's a lot that we, you know, we do know. And I think also there's a lot of... stuff like, you know, Kant and everything, where it kind of, like, says that, you know, there's no such thing as objective reality, it's subjective, you know, and that's kind of that idea that permeates in society where, yeah, that's one way of looking at it, but, you know, the other way, you know, there are other ways of looking at it, and, like, objective reality does exist, you know, and I think it's very important to tell people that, you know, what we do know. And I think also I don't think I could keep up with a lot of what you were saying, but I'll leave it there.
You're on your own. No, not sorry,
Mike.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I've come in at this at a Jan and John level, really, Michael, to be quite honest. I picked up some of the things that you said. Now, if I've understood what you're saying that the physical sciences are, with their data and collection about neurology, are saying that there's an element of not free will, determinism. So in other words, people in the test that they were sitting in, they didn't have free will. Mm. And the other side, you're saying that the social science is that we give meaning and value to lives, and that we're not predictable in the same way that the physical sciences are. Would that be correct? And that we can, on reflection, change things. But if we don't understand something, then what has science been collecting since the scientific revolution? They must have been collecting data even before that, presumably to collect and look at the world as they are now in situations to do with climate change. So from my point of view, I'm not too clear really about the meeting. I could come in at a prior sort of lower level, really, you know, to be honest. So from a Janet and John point of view, what is it that you're putting across, really?
The developments in neuroscience in particular, you know, the science of how the brain works and how that sort of translates to our bodily movements. The consensus from scientists is that can all be described as if we were machines.
Right.
You know,
robots.
Very complicated robots. Yeah, that's the way that a lot of the conclusions have reached. And the scientists who have that interpretation that we are just complicated robots, some of them say that the implications of that is that we should abandon concepts which don't fit in with that, like things like free will or purpose or meaning. And
but who's saying that?
Well, there's one chap called Alex Rosenberg, and he's written a book called The Atheist's Guide to Reality, which. And his views were sort of what I was quoting for quite a lot of it. So his view is that if you take developments in science and interpret them in that way, we should throw out all of these concepts that we sort of cherish, like free will, purpose and meaning, because science has just sort of made those concepts redundant. So in his view, not in mine, and not in... it's not a Marxist viewpoint, is that things like economics, social sciences, humanities, they all use concepts which science has made redundant. That's his view. So in his opinion, we should abandon a belief that things like economics can really tell us anything about how things work. He says we should just use them as entertainment because they stimulate interest, they make us feel happy if we're reading about something. So that's sort of a very strong view, which some developments in science could be taken to mean.
All right.
I've seen your hand. Let's see if anyone else wanted to come in at this stage.
Question of free will. Nobody would actually claim there's complete and absolute free will. I mean, you wouldn't mind, would you? Complete and absolute free will. You know, it's a relative thing, isn't it? And you mentioned the term altruism in an early part of your lecture. Now, there's some people in a society based on, you know, can cap the society based on self-interest, but there's an enormous amount of people who are altruistic. Now, that, presumably that's some sort of, it's a mechanism in their brain, obviously. They're going to do what they consider to be the right thing. Others are the complete opposite. Unfortunately, those are the complete opposite, like psychopaths and completely selfish people or dangerous people, they're the minority. But they've made a decision, presumably, although you could safely say those people are not really weighing things up. It's almost an automatic behaviour, because it's part of their personality. But the question is, what's made them like that, and what's made people who are altruistic? Recent London Olympics, you probably know, a lot of the runners are not just running, some of it might be ego trips, but they're running for all sorts of charities and, you know, raising, you know, collectively millions of pounds. So what's the reason for their behaviour? Now, as regards socialism, we'd have to take the attitude that there'd have to be at least some relative free will to establish it. You know, it's not going to establish itself. Now, that would be, it's dependent on a majority. But those who in this society are not in the least socialistic, let alone being socialist. Not the least, you know, they're not in the social. They would be a problem for a socialist society. Now, I mean, these things could be reconciled, but I mean, going around the houses a bit, there's no absolute free will, but would you say the free will which there is determined either because of physics or philosophy by society?
Obviously, I do believe that we do have free will, but that's within certain constraints. You know, there's the physical makeup of our brain, and also our sort of initial development as well. Obviously, someone who comes from a background where someone who comes from a violent background might learn that violence is a way of reacting. They might learn behaviours, and those behaviours would later influence their beliefs and their behaviour later on. And so I think our choices, our decisions are within constraints, you know, either through, how our brains and our bodies are put together, or through our, you know, formative years, you know, our initial development and what we learn from, you know, our parents or our family or society as a whole. And I suppose the question is to what extent things like that might determine it. You know, you could say, a child coming from a particularly violent background, we might be able to predict with whatever certainty whether or not they will later turn out violent themselves, or if they will react against that and not want it. So I think there's a mixture. Our free will is influenced, I wouldn't use the strongest word as determined, but is influenced by not only our upbringing, the people around us, the conditions that we live in, you know, material conditions, and also the conditions that our brains were wired up in. But yeah, and I suppose, you know, traits like that are sort of learnt, traits like altruism are sort of learnt by your circumstances.
Yeah, but those who don't come from a violent background, you know, those who might come from a very reasonable background, but they turn out to the contrary. What's the explanation for that? Mm-hmm.
Not sure if I know.
Yeah, but it's having too much to hang and frying. Do you want to come back, Simon, and say?
Yeah. Simply on the matter of, you say, sort of like, yeah, scepticism is reactionary. I really don't know where that's
coming. No, I didn't say scepticism was reactionary, but
you said
saying,
I don't know, is reactionary.
But, yeah, saying to people, that's a slogan, I don't know. No, scepticism, as Marx talked about, is challenging things.
My turn. Oh, right. Okay. Look at it this way. Two people, blindfolded, sat opposite each other. One of them's handed a cat. And it says, I think this cat's pink, and hands it off to the other one. The other one says, what do you mean it's a pink cat? And the first one says, well, what colour do you think it is? The point is that he had no information to say anything one way or the other. Yeah? It was actually making a statement in the first place that was stupid, not the specifics of whether the cat is pink or not. Yeah? You don't even know it's a cat. It could be a dog on a holiday. Yeah, a small dog on a holiday. You see? Right, so you just cannot say these things. Yeah? And if you try and say them, you are playing into a particular and previous system. Yeah? All you're doing is you're perpetuating old criteria. A fantastic one is this free will argument. I mean, what you are is basically exactly how you felt the way that you woke up in the morning. Yeah? Now, as soon as you start applying these criteria, you start screwing yourself up. If you say, do I have free will or not? As soon as you find out that it's something that happens in the world independent of your will, you then say, oh, well, it must be the other way, I must be determined. Yeah? Either of them is a nonsense, but both of them come from a particular way of looking at the world, which, as I say, is one that has developed within a private property world, where we are the ones that are externally motivated, externally mediated, in capitalism far more than previously. So these things basically come from living within private property society, and thus thinking entirely private property thoughts. So instead of saying, is it free will, is it determinism, we should realise that that whole debate is only based on our living in capitalism, and it doesn't reference anything outside of our debate, unless we say something stupid enough that we die of it. Yeah? Or one person will say something better than the other person, and we'll live better through it. Yeah? But the ideas live and die inside of us.
Can you just ask a question? What do you mean, I don't know? I mean, what on earth does that mean, you know? I mean, if you think about, you know, why are there wars? We do know why there are wars. And it's bloody obvious that, you know, and these kind of like becoming completely abstract in some philosophical, you know, navel-gazing. There's so much that we do know, and we need to educate people about what's happening. You know, and this is kind of like your philosophy is just like one of like paralysis, and, you know, we don't know, we don't know what'll happen, we don't know, you know, I mean, this is just nonsense.
It's precisely the opposite, if I might say.
Then let's have a dialogue. I'm thinking, can we open this up for anybody else wants to put their oar in?
Excuse me. Must be sorry, for sure.
I quickly reply to the reply. My point is that when you start over-philosophising things, if I've got that number of characters right, then that's when you get yourselves into trouble. That's why we are class struggle rather than philosophical thinkers. What we say is that, certainly what Marx was saying, I would actually think that apart from the name, which is like almost every single word of Marx has been forgotten in organisations that call themselves Marxist, yeah, or Marxian or whatever. But what I would say is that the reason that Marx relies on class struggle is because you depend on this reaction with the world, a constant, you know, how is it that I should be? I mean, so like, you know, I go and think private property thought, I get, you know, I get a bloody nose off it. That's the kind of thing that teaches me to do something different. Yeah? We are effectively, as a class, we are shoulder barging history. Yeah, we're the very fact of our existence, and everything that we think in this world, no matter how plausible it looks, yeah, is not even wrong. Yeah, it's the things that we have been taught by other people to get us to do things, yeah, that are alien to ourselves. Yeah, so instead of saying, well, what's the philosophical approach to us doing X, Y, Z, A, B, C, what I am saying is that we need to unpick that. Yeah? We need to get back to the point of saying, what is our class? What is our class X plus one? Yeah? How do we just basically push forward? Yeah? How do we say, this is working class, this is against our interests? Yeah? And we should basically trust to that, follow that through, and that is the means to revolution. Yeah? Whereas all these philosophical approaches have historically just led us into cul-de-sacs, because what they've done is they've explored different areas of private property space. That's why if you try and have a Bolshevik revolution following Bolsheviks around, rather than having a capitalist class trying to do its thing, yeah, if you start saying, well, let's see what Lenin says, and I'll follow Lenin around, Lenin is a doing philosophy, there we go, will just basically take you to another point in private property space, private property thinking, which is now state capitalism, yeah, whereby, you know, the working class is having something done for it and supposedly, you know, having a nicer world. Yeah? But that's nothing to do with what we could have as a class. What we want as a class is everything after capitalism is over. Yeah? We need to overthrow the whole infrastructure. Yeah? But we can't do that by thinking in capitalist ways. As I've said, all of our thought up to this point is private property thought.
Well, I don't agree with you, but...
Right. That's a
week. Well,
I have sympathy with Mike from the audience saying about the being at Janet and John level on the science bit, so in fact I think they agreed with that. I'm not sure what Simon is. I mean, what he just said sounded a lot better than what he said earlier about it, and I can sympathise with that. But I look on the sort of the philosophical part of the thing is that you've got to have ideas before you can formulate the action. I mean, you can have the if you like, the instinctive reaction, which is to the level going out on the street and down without with. But if you first thought about what you want to put in the place of the what you want to down with and out with, and think about the kind of society you want, and you begin by looking at the problems that there are and looking at the economic causes and seeing where you want to go. And this is where I think that, of course, we are children of the times that we grow up in, but we are imprisoned by that. But otherwise, there wouldn't be any possibility of change. We wouldn't have the we wouldn't be able to get to the ideas, and these ideas have come down. They've been there for generations. I mean, during the lifetime of this party, the ideas that have been there of what is wrong with having private ownership of the means of production instead of, as it should be, common ownership, that the world and its resources should be owned in common. And this comes out of the actual contradictions that there are in the system, that you have the people cooperating in various ways to produce the things that you need. Your materials come in different parts of the world. Some bits are made here, you know, at a sort of simplistic level somewhere else. But you have cooperation to produce the things, but you have private ownership. And because things are produced to be for sale, you have this ridiculous thing at the moment where there's this terrible problem of people being unemployed because they can't have access to the things that we all need because they need the money. And how are we going to get the money? We're going to have a jobs factory to provide them so that they can go and work and get the money, instead of looking at the world and thinking, what do we actually need? What are the things that we actually need? How many people does it need to produce these things that we actually need, and looking at the world from that way. But I mean, you know, to some extent, you've got to have the ideas before you can formulate the action to achieve what you want from the ideas.
Rob,
I think we've possibly got bogged down a bit in this discussion in sort of epistemological, you know, theory of knowledge sort of matters, and it's slightly getting a bit beyond me, you know, what so much here might have to do with science. I do find myself on the whole agreeing, I think, with what Simon's saying. Yeah, the only slight reservation I have is that I'm worried that you have this concept that we can't ever move outside of, you know, private property thought. I know, but you know, that's very much how it could be taken, and so, you know, therefore, how's there any hope of ever, you know, overcoming it, I guess, would be, you know, the way I approach that if I were raising objections to what you're saying. But anyway, I it's not been mentioned yet, and I don't have a massive sort of scientific training. I'm one of those kind of, you know, annoying people who did the humanities, but I'm kind of regular new scientist. Sort of a reader, so you know, I mean, I'm kind of interested in these issues. However, I mean, now whenever I'm having discussions with friends of mine from outside the party, I know quite a few people who, you know, call themselves skeptics and have sort of scientific backgrounds. What strikes me is that they don't realise that science, with a capital S, is just another ideology of progress. Right, and I think that's a much kind of richer approach in it, to take, you know, a more sort of Marxian approach to these things. You know, I don't think it's part of an inevitable and upward you know, way in which humanity is going to better itself. I think it's something you need to be really, really cautious of. I know, for example, within the various sort of labour movements since the 19th century, that's been a problem. I know Marx, my reading of Marx is that he didn't have that view. But a lot of people subsequently, you know, and some of his contemporaries, like Aveling, and of course, you know, dear old Engels himself, who I don't want to dig down too much, but Engels himself is very much a kind of scientific determinist, you know, in this respect. I don't know if any of the comrades or anybody knows, you know, more about this precise sort of matter. I mean, my understanding of it is that this idea that there's this thing called scientific socialism is more or less a kind of a misunderstanding on the part of you know, some later editors and translators, shall we say, Marx. I mean, I don't have anything, you know, concrete to add on that. But I mean, this is where I guess I get slightly almost close to being a bit postmodernist almost. You know, like I said, I'll reiterate again, I think science and a kind of blind belief that that's the only kind of way to look at the world, as you said, this was the book you were saying that.
Alex Rose.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that's an ideology of progress rather than something useful to discuss.
Michael.
Well, it's interesting that about this chap Rosenberg and others like him. It means in a sense that when if he's using his science as a scepticism or criticism of society and the social sciences, that's good in a sense, because that means people like ourselves and others in social sciences are concerned about the environment, their lives, people's lives, will then probably will have arguments to criticise him. Now, I wondered amongst the other scientific community, outside of his field of neuroscientists, that the environmental science, now how would he interpret what's happening in the larger society? He can't explain that by his own science, because it means it's a societal changes that are now evolving in the sense that the environment has been impacted upon by the action of a society dependent on fossil fuels. So how would he be able to address that? I mean, it's all very well people in these narrow little fields saying something outside and beyond their area in the social sciences. But then again, even amongst the other science, if he says that everything is an abstraction, then governments, all the various departments, data that's collected on homelessness, food production, food is destroyed because the markets is degenerated too much. I mean, this is all just to him then, fairy tale or an artificial world that he's generating. So in other words, it's like behind a closed door, doesn't go out anywhere, doesn't... something like that.
Yeah. Do I come back on that?
Yeah.
I mean, with the sort of the view of people like Alex Rosenberg, he would say that we should rely on physics to sort of tell us everything about the world and about our behaviour. So he would say that concern for the environment could be something which should have importance, but only from a scientific perspective. He would say it's nonsensical to say that it's morally correct to preserve the environment. He would say that the environment should be preserved, as a matter of conserving resources. He calls himself a bit of a lefty, but he doesn't really go into much detail about the political implications of focusing just on science and downplaying the role of the humanities and social sciences. Not sure if that answers your question. But
I mean, it does.
Yeah.
But it's funny that he sees the world in a kind of physical, a scientific assessment rather than, a living sort of a culture, which is culture of, various smaller cultures, but the culture of, production for profits.
Just quickly, he doesn't deny that all that happens. He just says that we've got the wrong way of explaining it. Yeah, and he would say that it should be explained through sort of as if it was all one big machine, so that you've got various inputs and outputs in society as well as in people, and that's the way we should explain it, rather than using concepts which he feels are irrelevant, like purpose, meaning, that kind of thing.
Right, at this stage, short commercial break. Although the meeting's free and the refreshment's free, we have certain expenses to face, so I'm going to ask for a collection. You're not obliged to contribute, but if you can, it would be much helpful. So, Mike, if you don't mind passing that round, that'd be...
Cheers.
Okay.
Thank
you. Okay,
Mike, can you just come back in on that point that was being made about, psychopathic behaviour or sociopathic behaviour and not being in a violent kind of, background, I think there's always an explanation for something, and that these things have just happened for no reason. I mean, I always see it as like damage. It's not that somebody is, and I don't believe in the born bad sort of idea. I think that there's lots of things that actually can't be determined, by the outside. Like there are these sort of people who've lived like Franz Kafka lives, haven't they? And they've, and there's all this rage building up inside. You don't know really, but there's always a reason. And that this idea that I think a lot of the media puts out, like that these monsters, and it's not connected with anything. It's not the fact that we're living in a world where you're really alienated and you're fed violence all the time. There is always a reason. It's just not easy to understand what the reason is. And I think as well, I mean, some of the stuff that you were saying about the mind and how the mind works. I mean, I was reading this thing on post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, that a lot of people who've been in wars have this experience of post-traumatic stress. And it's similar, they say, to, you know, a trauma in childhood where the it's like a computer where the brain is frozen at that point, and then you get frozen in that moment, and then you're re-experiencing it throughout your life, because that things trigger it, so you're not responding to what's actually happening, it's to this experience from before, and so people can end up thinking, oh, there's something really wrong with me. Well, there is an explanation for why they are like that. Anyway, I'll leave it there, thanks.
Yeah, I mean, could you have that condition in a social society?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, it's not going to be perfect, is it? Well, it'd be less, wouldn't it?
Well, I'll make a point if...
Sure.
There was a couple of things that Rob said, and also that sort of Simon said before about some of my notes sort of did go down that route of saying that, you know, science is an ideology that stems from class society, and in hindsight maybe I should have sort of made a bit more of that in my talk, but I suppose I like to think that what I said in my talk is compatible with the Marxist view that science is an ideology that's produced from class society at a certain point. And rather than being sort of as objective as it likes to think it is. And I suppose, if anything, that obviously if someone was to give a talk with the same remit as mine in, you know, 50 years' time, it would be different to mine. And, you know, same again, if someone gave a talk on the same subject 50 years ago, it would be different. And that would show that, you know, developments in science which sort of develop alongside, you know, sort of economic developments in society, that they're not fixed either. So I suppose the conclusions made by some of these hardline determinists, you could probably sort of trace that as to being consistent with capitalism in a certain stage, you know, with the sort of the messages that capitalism sends out and the level of technology in that point. So I suppose what I would say would be that, yeah, and the debate over free will would have to sort of keep up with that, and vice versa. And, you know, science would have to keep up with sort of philosophical understanding of free will. But that's accepting that sort of both are ideologies. You know, science is an ideology, and sort of philosophy in its various forms is an ideology. But I suppose my point was that, I think I made it earlier, that, you know, issues like free will and determinism, they've been around for a lot longer than neuroscience, and I'm guessing that they'll still persist in a different form beyond class society as we currently know it. I'm not sure if that really answers the point, but
yeah. That sounded a bit like a winding up.
Yeah, if that's
if everybody else wants to say anything, but